Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day, Mark Kenny here with Democracy Sausage, the weekly podcast on politics and policy from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute, the School of Politics and International Relations, and the wonderful Crawford School of Public Policy. Well, we've had the budget, albeit a pretty strange one at that, and we're well on the way now with a vaccine rollout. So there's a sense, notwithstanding the budget assumption of a closed international border until this time next year, there's a sense of recovery, of returning to normal. But even if that turns out to be correct and there are no further large setbacks, is it good enough? Or should we be disappointed that our political representatives have failed to seize the opportunity of a crisis like this to build back better, not just in the economy, but perhaps in the political economy, in the society and in our political system? My guest this week has been with us a few times before. He's always good value, Professor Mark Evans from the University of Canberra. He's a political scientist and the director of the Democracy 2025 project based at the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House. Mark, welcome back. I want to talk to you about Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer, or should I say Sir Keir Starmer, which we can get to in a little bit. But first, am I right in saying that apropos what I just said in the introduction there, you feel a bit angry or disappointed about really the sort of lack of ambition in really using this pandemic period, this crisis, to sort of reset some aspects of the way we do our governing?
Yes, well, I guess that lots of people were expecting that the economic and social dislocation that would emerge from COVID-19 would be the big disruptive event in Australian politics that the global financial crisis was for many other democracies around the world. And as you know, I've written on this topic for a while now since I've been in Australia. But in my view, there's been kind of a culture of complacency over the last two decades that's characterized both Labour and coalition governments, a sense of policy limbo on the big public policy problems of our time. And we know that the academic literature tends to tell us that actually you're only going to shake people out of that complacency if they're experiencing good times economically, if there is some type of disruptive event. We kind of looked at maybe digital transformation was going to be that event a couple of years ago. And certainly it's true to say that the Australian Public Service has responded quite positively to the reform potential, particularly in the area of service provision that digital technology affords. But certainly COVID-19, as we sit here at the moment, hasn't had that disruptive impact, although there have been some areas of progress. But for example, emergency relief is an area where I've been working for the last 4 months. And there was a big expectation amongst providers that with the end of JobKeeper, there would be a surge mm-hmm. for the need for emergency relief. And as we sit here, that's not happened. So actually, you're going to have a lot of providers that are going to have to give money back to government in expectation of a relief surge.
But that's a good thing, isn't it?
It is a good thing. So obviously, this is where the big moral dilemma for me personally comes in, because you don't want to wish misery on anybody. So,
you don't want to wish misery, but at the same time, as you said, in sort of good economic times, like normal times outside of the pandemic, for example, there's no great impetus for change. You know, people tend to coast along if they're economically comfortable, which broadly they are. I mean, let us both go on the record and acknowledge that there are plenty of people in this community who are not as comfortable, and there are, of course, 160,000 Australians who are homeless, at least, and all kinds of economic stresses and other domestic problems. So, making sure that is acknowledged. But broadly speaking, when things are going well, you don't have any great impetus for change. Whereas in this circumstance, you would think there might be, because everything's sort of been thrown up in the air by the pandemic. And the fact that there isn't that level of dislocation for those emergency services, those relief services you're talking about, suggests that the assistances that the government has dialed up for COVID, for the pandemic, JobKeeper being by far the most expensive of all of them, they've largely kind of done their job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has been a period of effective governance, and that's translated in terms of, as you know, the doubling of trust in people in government that we've experienced over the last year, which has been an incredible transformation. Although, having said that, there is an ABC tracker poll that suggests movement away from the coalition over the last 3 months as a consequence of certain of the scandals. But we have had effective
and perhaps the vaccine.
The vaccine rollout.
Or strollout, as some people are calling
it. Yeah. I guess I'm a little bit more skeptical about that, because it's not, the vaccine has not been a pressing issue, I think, for the majority of Australians. Why? Well, because we've not seen lots of people dying around us. Mm. You know, I mean, my dad lives in Clitheroe in Lancashire, and basically within a 50-mile radius of where he lives, over 50,000 people have died.
You know, bloody hell.
Six members of my family have had COVID-19. Thank God they've all survived that. But if that's your lived experience, then the vaccine is an imperative. And one of the reasons why Boris Johnson has had this comeback is because, you know, as we sit here today, 56 million Brits have had their first jab. And the vaccine rollout is viewed to be a tremendous success, despite the horror governance that had preceded it in the UK.
Yeah, that's right, because that seems to be the sort of strange inverse relationship here that's happened. The countries, I mean, whether this is by accident or sort of causally related, I guess, you know, we can debate, but the countries that really buggered up their response to the pandemic, that went through periods of denial and had inconsistent policy and failed to close borders and take it seriously and didn't set up their health systems correctly and all that. And I'm principally thinking of developed countries like the US and the UK, have in the second phase, in the vaccine phase, have really performed very well. Now, there may be, as I say, a sort of a causal relationship with that, which you're talking about there as well. That, you know, when you've had vast suffering, many, many thousands of deaths, that is going to sharpen your resolve to get the vaccine and get that program working urgently. And that's what those two countries have done, and others as well. So maybe that is maybe that explains the inverse relationship. I don't know that it fully explains.
It doesn't fully explain it, because, of course, the other major comparison between Australia and the UK is that UK airports are international hubs. London is the centre of international finance.
Yeah.
The internationalisation dimension of this is critical to the British economy, particularly post-Brexit. And, you know, one of the benefits of living in Australia and the weaknesses for many of us is that we are out on the limb geographically. You know? So as soon as we took that decision to close our international borders really quickly, which was a fantastic decision, we were going to be okay. And this is interesting, actually, because I was reading the other day, there was a paper by the Behavioural Insights Unit in the UK that had basically said to Boris Johnson, look, if you go for quick lockdown of the border, don't think that you're going to get the behavioural change that you think you'll get from British people. Brexit has demonstrated that they're not predictable. Right. And apparently that delayed the decision as well.
Yeah, I heard some talk about this going back to the early part of 2020 as well, that even the senior medical authorities, the equivalent of, the Brendan Murphys and people like that that we have in this country, they had made an assumption. This is right at the very start of the pandemic. They worked on an assumption that a lockdown of the kind that the Chinese had effected in Wuhan was just not viable. It was just not tenable within a democratic society, that Britons wouldn't do it, and that therefore it wasn't within their armory. And they were quite surprised when lockdowns in other places outside of, you know, authoritarian states started to work. And, so in a sense, they didn't even look at what would have been the most effective measure of controlling the pandemic as it really began to gallop, which is to basically shut down social interaction, get people to stay in their homes and social distance.
Yeah, that's right. So the irony was that they followed the evidence, but they followed the evidence from behavioural science rather than the evidence from epidemiologists.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
And of course, subsequently, we've still seen a big contestation around the evidence, as we know, as you'll always get, and evidence is always value driven. We know that.
Yeah.
But by and large, the evidence that the Australian Commonwealth Government has followed has been it has been risk averse. There's no doubt about that. But as we sit here, the economic impacts have not been disastrous.
And that risk aversion is interesting because it's been what you might say, at least in prospect, that is in thinking forward before you've done it, you would call it risk averse in an economic sense. It turns out not to be risk averse in a political or social sense.
Yeah.
Governments, the tougher governments have been, the more resolve they have been accredited with by voters. So, you know, I always joked through that period during the Queensland state election last year that, you know, obviously Scott Morrison was on Anastasia Palaszczuk's campaign team, because every time he went to Queensland or he attacked the Premier for keeping the state's border shut, it was adding votes to her column. Queenslanders were saying she's standing up to Canberra, she's standing up to this external pressure to let people with infection into this state, and she's on our side. You know, that was
the politics became more local, didn't they?
Exactly. And then we saw the same thing in WA, of course. In fact, we've seen listeners to this podcast will know I keep quoting this, but there have been five elections in the COVID era in Australia now, but to the two territories and three states, WA, Tasmania and Queensland. And they've, in all five cases, the incumbents have been re-elected.
Yeah.
And in WA, of course, the opposition, the Liberal opposition, officially ceased to exist. Mm. It was so decimated. And you would probably say Mark McGowan, the WA Premier, was, of all of those state territory leaders, the most overtly parochial, the most, you know, within the context of the nation, the most sort of isolationist almost, you know.
Yeah, because he's looking east.
Xenophobic even.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and he did make that point. He is looking east, and he did make that point even when he had the border shut. It didn't do, and you were just touching on this a second ago, didn't do his state economically any great harm. At least, like you take about tourism, for example, he pointed out that more West Australians travel east for their holidays than Australians travel west into WA. Therefore, if West Australians spent their tourism dollars in WA, they actually wind up with more money, not less.
Yes, absolutely.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. But, you know, we do forget that we live on a continent.
Yeah.
You know?
Good point, yeah.
So regional identity, politics, and regional economic issues are really, really important. Yeah. And we often forget that.
That's right. And the sheer distance involved means that there is a lot of different territory. You can actually, for example, have quite a lot of tourism within the state like WA. Look at the size of it. I mean, it's bigger than most countries in the world.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So it is really interesting the way in which the blend of politics changes across Australia from state to state, from territory to territory. And by and large, the big governance decisions up until the vaccine rollout have been really good. And it's quite interesting that the team involved in directing the vaccine rollout has been changed now. So clearly the government is worried about the potential electoral deficit that could be caused by that.
And, they're saved, funnily enough, the government that is saved, funnily enough, in the severity of that negative reaction by the same thing you referred to before, which is that we don't have the virus in the community here. And so people can see that there's been a technical underperformance, and I don't mean to understate that, but I mean compared even to what the Prime Minister said, there was going to be, 3 million by the end of March and 4 million or something. I forget the numbers now, but it was, there was a very ambitious timeline for the vaccination program within the context of a fairly tardy, fairly slow acquisition program in the second half of last year, I thought. I mean, other countries were signing deals with Pfizer and Moderna and Novavax and others, and we were relatively insouciant about that, it seemed to me. The government kept telling us there's a portfolio approach. We've got all these different vaccines and that we're going to be protected by that. Turned out that portfolio was largely AstraZeneca and UQ, and UQ, of course, didn't materialise, and AstraZeneca has since had the sorts of problems that have meant that it needs to now be restricted largely to over 50s. So there have been some problems in that regard. But the political sort of downside for the government, as some of the polls are showing, has been relatively muted. And it's probably a function of the fact that, as you say, the virus just isn't raging here and we don't have that level of urgency.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. The immediacy of the threat isn't there, so people are less worried about it. I mean, I guess the question is really: are there any signs of change emerging within communities across Australia? And there are a few little kind of signals that are interesting to look at. So, for example, since 2019. We've seen historic registration of new political parties in Australia, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
And then this year, for the first time, we had a national conference of independents and the creation of an umbrella movement called Independence Can. And the key person behind that is Cathy McGowan, who, led the Voice for Indi movement. And they've been almost franchising their approach.
She's written a book about it, and I think even her sister's got a book as well. And
that's right, yeah. They've been strategically targeting particular constituencies on the premise that if they can get 20 independents up, they can hold the balance of power and they can force through some real change.
That would be a reshaping of Australian politics right there, wouldn't it? And it wouldn't be being delivered from our political representatives. It would be delivered from voters who are, as we know, tending to walk away from and this is a long-term trend, but walking away from the major parties, if we compare it to the sorts of loyalties that might have existed, say, 30 or 50 years ago.
Absolutely. So the de-alignment trend is in line with this.
Mm.
You could say the localism trend is in line with this as well,
yeah.
Potentially. I mean, there are a number of cabinet ministers with seats in WA who must be worried about that. And then, ironically, there's obviously international trends as well, that in most of the large democracies, there are big movements for reform. So, again, in those countries that have felt the threat more directly, you are seeing the emergence of devices like citizens' assemblies to deliberate on climate change, but linking climate action to post-COVID recovery. And we've seen those assemblies created in France and Germany. Obviously, Biden has triggered a major process of public engagement around climate action as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the same in Britain. But ironically, and maybe that this will be part of our discussion later on, you know, the Conservatives under Johnson have been very progressive on climate action.
Yeah.
So that's been part of the problem for Starmer's Labour, is that they've kind of stolen the sort of the green space. Mm. So that's proving a problem for Keir Starmer.
Well, we will come back to that, because that is an interesting, very contrasting difference with the layout of that problem in Australia, the way the political parties are addressing it. But there's also so many other issues you've raised there, and we'll come to them as well. I'd like to also talk about this, for example, this notion of citizens' assemblies and where we're up to with that. Let's take a quick break and we'll go straight to that.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, Mark Evans, we were talking just before the break about a number of things, but citizens' assemblies you mentioned. You and I penned a piece, I reckon it was about a year ago, a quite optimistic piece, I think it's fair to say, talking about this moment, the onset of the pandemic and the changes that were happening. And I think we were, self-consciously being optimistic about how voters could look at, how citizens really could look at the reset this crisis offered and what might come from it. Was it a chance for some democratic renewal? So I just thought we might look at that for a moment, because that goes to the sort of disappointment with which we, began this podcast today. But also, as you say, some of the other more positive developments that have happened in some of those other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't seen much, really, have we? I mean, you mentioned the independence movement, the independence can, and that tendency, that de-alignment tendency, but we haven't seen much in the way of, kind of any real momentum for change from our major political parties in the way we do our democracy, at least not as a function of this pandemic.
No, absolutely. And, and one thing that Albanese and Starmer have shared is the view that they should engage in a constructive opposition approach rather than articulating a new vision in contrast to the incumbent government in both countries.
Yeah, that's a kind of a trap, but it's also needed. It's the sense that we all face this exogenous threat, the virus in this case, and the economic mayhem that can be caused. Voters want their politicians to stop bickering and get into problem solving. We've seen that. That accounts for the spike in trust that you referred to earlier. But it's also great for incumbents, isn't it?
Yeah, it's brilliant for incumbents because it means that the opposition leaders really can't make any sort of cut through unless there's some kind of crisis but even there. I mean, look, maybe it is that the scandals that have been experienced in recent times are kind of the preserve of the chattering classes and that most Australians aren't really bothered about them. I personally would hope that that's not the case.
You're talking about the scandals involving the treatment of women, allegations of sexual abuse, crimes and underrepresentation of women, all of those stories that have sort of dominated the first part of this year in political terms.
Yeah, and also sports rorts.
Sports rorts pretty much got obliterated by the pandemic, didn't it?
The start of
2020. I mean, that was kind of at fever pitch as an issue, and then the pandemic occurred and it just didn't rate.
So we've really seen sort of a consistent number of integrity challenges to this government.
Mm.
And they basically had a Teflon factor. You know, they've been able to evade any real scrutiny in relation to these issues because what we do know, there's no doubt about that. I mean, intuitively, you would know that where there's sports rorts in the system, there's other rorting in the system.
Yeah.
Right. And obviously that's probably the major reason why the process of ICAC reform has kind of been kicked into the long grass or has slowed considerably.
Yeah.
Because of worries about what they might find elsewhere. Now, I have to say that this isn't peculiar to a coalition government. We know that similar things have happened under Labor government. So when I'm talking about the integrity problems, it's a systems problem. It's not a problem peculiar to a political party.
Absolutely. I mean, if you don't have proper accountability mechanisms, proper mechanisms for policing these things and for monitoring them, then you will eventually have, you know, sort of encultured behavior that is unacceptable, that we don't want, that is not meant to occur. And the politicization of public monies, you know, these minor grants programs, for example, which might be minor in some of the grants, but pretty major in terms of the aggregate money, they seem inevitable if you don't have proper guardrails around them. And that's really the lesson here. It's not just about whether the coalition is, you know, sort of uniquely guilty. It isn't.
Mm, absolutely. You know, so when we saw those types of developments a year ago, obviously there seemed to be the space there for some sort of renewal project, democratic renewal project. But obviously the key issue is that most people would agree that in times of crisis, you expect governance to be more top-down because you're engaged in crisis management and you need to, in many ways, have a command and control approach to the marshalling of resources in response to crisis. But the intuition was that as soon as we started to move towards a more recovery stage, that there would be a need for a more inclusive politics because there's greater contestation over the resources. And it's going to be very, very difficult to maintain kind of a national project around recovery unless there's more inclusive engagement, right? And again, we saw that perhaps the National Cabinet could play that role. If the National Cabinet became an instrument for more political inclusion, right? So obviously the key critique of COAG was that it was a creature of the Prime Minister, it was top down. But actually, ironically, it did have an institutional architecture of committees that actually brought public servants across the country together to engage in some collaborative problem solving. And in some areas, like closing the gap, for example, but probably more in the case of education reform, it was through COAG that the major policy strides have been made, in my view, over the last two decades.
Well, that's true, although having been pretty close to that process in a reporting sense for a long time, I think it's also true to say that, yes, it had the architecture, but the architecture was somewhat, you know, it was sort of scarchitecture. It was you know, there was a lot of built up process around everything, to the point where it was, things were slow.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
And if you compare, I've thought about this a bit, because I thought when Morrison announced the National Cabinet, I thought, well, what's different about this? Is it just a change of name? And I think the two key differences are that it's the leaders without officials, largely speaking, the National Cabinet, but it's also very, very focused. In the case of the National Cabinet so far, it's been focused largely on the pandemic. So having one key area of focus gives it much greater chance to, one, you know, to have the development of expertise, but also to be, you know, very sort of results driven. Whereas COAG became very process driven.
Yes.
You know, and as you say, it would be looking at correctional service, it'd be looking at roads, regulations, it'd be looking at you know, education, health, so many other different areas, closing the gap. And because of that breadth of workload, would have necessarily working committees that are looking at that, officials operating, you know, at official to official level and so forth. It all sort of makes sense. Mm.
Right. Yeah, look, I get that, really, and I agree with that, and I am not hearing praise of COAG. but what I'm saying is that the National Cabinet, initially we thought it was going to be a more collaborative decision-making venue, and at the beginning it looked as if that was going to be the case.
Yeah, and there was a fair bit of it, actually. Yeah. If you think about hotel quarantine, for example, it was the states essentially shouldering what the Constitution sets out as a federal responsibility, not necessarily exclusively, but certainly as a federal responsibility. But it was the states who shouldered the burden of running quarantine in their states through the hotel quarantine system. We know the political cost that, and the health cost that had in and economic cost that had in Victoria. But nonetheless,
I was excited that this could potentially be a force for power sharing, you know, because my view is that one of the major issues that the Australian Federation confronts is that the executive has become increasingly powerful. I mean, we know that in public expenditure terms, it's the second most centralized federal system in the world to Belgium. Now it accounts. I mean, this was before COVID. It accounted for 48% of public expenditure. But post-COVID, it must be way over that, way over that. So as we know, money talks in terms of the distribution of power. So I was excited by the idea that the National Cabinet could become a building block for a more devolved federation and the greater sharing of power, where premiers and chief ministers would have the ability to basically develop new ideas about policy. Because actually, you know, when we make the observation, we really haven't seen much policy change emerging from Commonwealth governments over the last two decades. By and large, I think that's true empirically, but we've seen a lot more happening at the state and territory level in terms of, particularly in terms of, you know, social inclusion, particularly in terms of supporting small and family-sized businesses.
Social inclusion is a really interesting one, and climate change too. I mean, all the states, for example, have net zero by 2050 targets.
Yeah.
The Commonwealth doesn't, but the states do, and almost raises the question, does it matter as much that the Commonwealth doesn't if the states all do?
Yeah, but as we know, there's been an uneven pattern in terms of learning across the states as well. So obviously there've been some pioneers, but there are other states that have not made the same progress. But I think that the insight, which is we need to use the innovation and new thinking that's emerging through our states and territories in our national politics and our national decision making more effectively. I mean, in my view, the genius of a federation should be about policy learning. because it gives us the ability to try things in different places and to learn the lessons.
Yeah.
And the problem, I think, is that we've not done enough of that over the last two decades.
Well, hasn't that, and partly that's been because, I mean, of political timidity, and we can talk about that, but also isn't it true to say that there is a, there has been this assumption, this kind of underlying assumption that uniformity is good, that that variation between jurisdictions on laws is a sort of an economically bad thing, you know?
The old sort of broad gauge, because internationally there's been the drift towards subsidiarity, you know? So elsewhere the view is localism is important, difference is important, and actually the key to being competitive in the global economy is having economic plans that make sense in the context of the regional to the global.
Whereas the argument has actually been often that if you're a business in Australia, you have some sort of challenge dealing with and particularly if you're an export business, you have some sort of difficulties, inevitable ones, dealing with, you know, foreign markets and regulations, but you shouldn't have to have those sorts of problems internally. You know, you should have the same regulations applying to your whole processes wherever they happen to be located in Australia. That's you know, it's been a pretty predominant business argument for a long time.
Yeah, but again, if you look at China, you know, there's this presumption that this China has this command and control economy, but the engine rooms of economic growth in China have been through the special economic action zones.
Yeah,
it's been a devolved economic project around those industries that the central government has chosen as the winners in the economy, or the potential winners into the future. So, you know, there are some lessons here to be drawn
from some to be drawn, perhaps not drawn.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about, you know, something you mentioned before as well, which brings us neatly to Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer, and I guess by extension to Scott Morrison and Anthony Albanese. And that is, I'm really fascinated, as you are, by the difference between, on the climate question, for example, between our two polities, that is, between the British one and the Australian one. In Britain, the Tories, Boris Johnson has been very muscular about pursuing progressive climate change policies, policies that would be, that would seem to be radical in the Australian context, and yet they're being pursued by a Conservative government. In Australia, of course, it's the opposite. I mean, we've got sort of almost, you know, kind of gridlock. Labor had a pretty ambitious 45% by 2030 target at the last election, but it seems to have even backed away from that now, even as the world has kind of moved to that sort of place. What's going on in politics in the UK, that, as you said? I mean, Boris Johnson just won the Hartlepool by-election, which was one of those red wall Labor constituencies in the north that hasn't fallen to the Tories for, I don't know, ever.
But voted Brexit.
Yeah, that's right. It voted Brexit, and that's actually the important point, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, look, there's a lot there. What I would say about climate action is that the key difference between the Conservative Party in the UK and the coalition is obviously the Liberals are hamstrung by the Nationals in terms of the approach to climate. That's one. Two, the Conservative Party in the UK have a what's called a cosmopolitan agenda, an urban agenda.
Right.
Right. They don't have although it's a Conservative Party, and obviously one of the major changes in the sociology of the Conservative Party has been the movement from land and the ruling class owning land to obviously the urban economy and the focus on the urban economy. And they did that obviously to ensure that they survived electorally. You know, I mean, the Conservative Party, as you know, has always been a very pragmatic party. So as soon as they saw that through the European Union, firstly, a greening of politics across Europe. And we were also seeing the greening of British industry, the greening of big business, and the development of a small liberal agenda in big business, then it was natural for them to embrace climate action. I mean, Australia is the exception to the rule in this sense.
Yeah.
You know, that if you look at the, I don't know, if we looked at the top 200 Australian companies, right, my intuition would be that the majority of them would have small L liberal agendas, right, in terms of diverse, you know, embracing a diverse workforce and all those sorts of things. But of course, the big barrier is the commodities industry, which of course still contributes very significantly to GDP, less so to employment, as we know. That's been a little bit of a...
Overstated, generally speaking.
But obviously, we have a coalition government that is kind of between the devil and the deep blue sea, and has been risk averse in making a big step one way or the other. The key question is whether Biden will drive them towards the small L liberal agenda on certain issues.
And we know Boris Johnson made a telephone call to Scott Morrison just in the last few days to again urge him towards a net zero by 2050 commitment. Most people seem to think that there is some sort of commitment like that coming between now and when that UN climate change conference happens in Glasgow in November. So maybe there's some movement here, but it's been so reluctant. You know, you said, for example, that the Libs are hamstrung by the Nats, and I think that's undoubtedly true. And we can't know this, of course, what I'm about to propose, but how different could that have been if the Libs had actually had a front-footed policy and been trying to bring the Nationals along with them?
What convincing could they have done? Well, of course, that's what we thought might happen with Turnbull, didn't we? But of course, in the end, his thirst for power was greater than his thirst for achievement. Yeah. In other words, he was willing to make the compromise to stay in power, but then, of course, he was knifed in the back. It proved to be the wrong gambit strategically.
I was just thinking last – I might write something about this, but I was just thinking the last day or two that it's quite interesting that you look at that budget that the government just unveiled, and there's some – you know, there's a bit of sort of chatter and blowback in the conservative end of the Liberal Party now about not having – you know, about having just gargantuan debt and not having a proper plan for it, for paying it down, and how this is so different from the conservative, you know, mantra we've heard for a long time. And I was thinking, funnily enough, they got rid of Malcolm Turnbull because they thought he was too moderate, but I don't think Malcolm Turnbull would have delivered that budget.
No, he would have run the numbers.
Yeah.
He became a numbers man.
Well, yeah, but even if...
In terms of winning elections...
True, but I think it's a positive for them electorally, or at least it operates as not as a negative. But I just think Malcolm Turnbull, one, wouldn't have wanted to look that progressive because of how that would have played within the coalition, and his, you know, he obviously had very much an eye to the party room. But also I think he was more economically conservative, more economically, let me put it another way, more economically liberal than was evidenced by that budget. I mean, that was the kind of pragmatism you talk about in the Tory party.
Yeah. And of course, now he's out of power, it's interesting to see what agendas he's jumping on.
Yeah.
I mean, I talked about Independence Can. They have a podcast series, and Turnbull does a podcast with them. And he talks about his worries about Australian democracy. And obviously he focuses in particularly on ownership and control of the media and issues around that.
Yeah.
But he also talks about the importance of there being competitive elections and how independents are important in terms of competitive elections.
Yeah.
So he is sort of by stealth developing this sort of renewal project, and he wants to now be seen as a polymath reformist out of power, which is obviously interesting. And for those of us who thought that he may be potentially a turning point, desperately disappointing.
Well, I mean, he was on this podcast only probably a month ago now, and it was a very interesting discussion. If you haven't heard it, I'd encourage you to listen to it.
Yeah.
But you know, one of the things he did concede, and my experience is that prime ministers, former prime ministers, and I've spoken to many of them, pretty much never concede anything. You know, pretty well everything they did was right. One of the things he did concede, I think, was at least partially, was the possibility, as I was putting it to him, that he should have gone to an election much sooner than he did. Mm-hmm. There was a great deal of optimism around when he replaced Abbott. He was very popular. It took some time for it to, but not very long, for it to sort of start to become apparent that there had been what some have called a kind of a Faustian pact. You know, he'd agreed to park some of the things for which he was most known about, you know, his position on emissions trading, his position on the Republic, his position on same-sex marriage. All of these things were essentially, you know, proscribed from being accelerated. Whereas had he gone to an election relatively soon, he might not have ended up in that very difficult situation that he did after the election in 2016 of having a one-seat majority and all of the authority problems that attended to that.
That's right.
And he might have been able to say to the right, well, look, I've won a thumping election win in my own right now, so you can all bugger off.
Yeah. So instead of seeing the sort of courageous leader with an active agenda, we saw the risk-averse leader.
Yeah, we saw someone who was very conscious of his party because he'd lost the leadership once before, of course, in 2009.
Yeah.
And he seemed to be almost—
And he remembered that.
Yeah, he did. He remembered it, I think, in a deeper way than many of us who were watching on at the time.
Yeah.
Perhaps appreciated. Now, look, we're getting close to time, but I do want to get to Starmer and to some extent any similarities with Albanese's dilemma. But why is it that Starmer isn't cutting through in your view? Is it just the incumbency factor during the crisis?
No.
Labour voters,
he hasn't articulated a clear policy agenda, right?
No.
So when Blair came to power, he very much looked at what new Labour would need to look at in contrast to old Labour.
Yeah.
Right? And then, of course, we had the dial back to old Labour under Jeremy Corbyn. And Starmer's problem is how he defines the Labour Party now in contrast to old Labour and to new Labour.
Yeah.
Right? So he's criticised really for not having a clear articulation of what the Labour Party stands for. And in the meantime, Johnson, right, has shifted towards a full employment approach because of the very significant fiscal stimulus.
Yeah, very similar to here. Right?
Yeah, and he's obviously taken on the climate action process very, very clearly. But he's also, and this matters very much in terms of Hartlepool, they've committed significantly to regional economic development, particularly in the northeast and in those vulnerable constituencies. So Hartlepool has been a major gain of investment to the Tees Valley. Then you've got the success of the vaccine, the vaccine rollout. And then you've got the fact that actually there's been some trends here in this region for a while. There was a high Brexit vote in Hartlepool.
These are the people who kind of responded to, you know, Dominic Cummings's fantastic political slogan in that referendum.
That's right.
Take back control.
Yeah. So you basically
sort of feel like that Britain had drifted away from them, and they've taken it back. Yeah.
Yeah. So they've connected much better with those that had been left behind by globalization than Labour, because Labour have been bogged down in this class and identity war under Corbyn. So that's been a huge issue. And then the other thing is the media in the UK always downplay the popularity of Johnson. Right.
Yeah, it's a good point, isn't it? Yeah.
Now he, you know, internationally he may look like a buffoon, but I tell you, if he was in this room now, I had a lot to do with Boris Johnson because I was on this, I was linked to Yorkshire Forward, which was a regional development agency, and he was the minister who was on Yorkshire Forum, right, focusing on the Hull area. And right. So I was on this committee with him for a while. And I tell you, he was a very, very engaging man, yeah, very funny,
yeah,
very funny.
Yeah.
You couldn't help not like him. Mm. His politics were very different in those days, I should say. They were a lot more sort of...
Eclectic, weren't they?
They were very eclectic.
Yeah.
He's a
magnetic personality.
He's
in that
a
sense,
magnetic
yeah.
personality. Yeah. Whereas Starmer, again, and again, because of the work that I did on constitutional reform, I do know him. We've actually written some pieces together. Look, his background is as a human rights activist. The chattering classes love Keir Starmer.
He's a polished barrister.
He's
isn't he?
Very polished. And he was the biggest, probably one of the key influences on the development of the British Bill of Rights,
mm.
right? But a big internationalist, right? And it's Sir Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just not sure that he, in identity politics terms, he connects up with the people of Hartlepool.
What a horrible irony, though, that the Labour leader is having trouble connecting with the sort of blue-collar workers because he's called... Among other things, because he's Sir Keir Starmer.
Yeah, and look, I think Albanese suffers from a related issue, which is that he is very much associated with traditional Labour,
mm.
with old Labour politics, with union corruption or perceptions of union corruption.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I think, to be fair to him, he doesn't have a particular union background himself.
No, he doesn't, but he's perceived as that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that is... an accurate representation of him. But certainly, as you know, I do these focus groups. I do 34 focus groups all over Australia every single year. And the big problem that they have had with Shorten and with Albanese is they're viewed to be politicians of the past and not of the future.
Yeah, interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And actually, look, Turnbull was great at engaging with the chattering classes, but he wasn't good at engaging with everyday Australians.
This is what people used to say. They said Turnbull was popular with a whole lot of people who weren't actually going to vote Liberal.
Yeah. So, look, the genius of the Conservative Party and, you know, events, dear boy, events have helped them, mm. is the way in which they flipped traditional class politics on its head.
Yeah.
Right? And you're seeing in the UK realignment around age. So your generation matters in terms of who you vote for.
Yeah.
Education, right? And region, right? So we're seeing a realignment around those things. And Boris Johnson's benefited from that.
It's an extraordinary situation. Mark, I could talk to you all day, seriously.
Mm.
Perhaps after we turn off the microphone, we will talk all day. And I think, you know, it just occurs to me, we might revisit that piece that we wrote a year ago and gauge where we are up to.
Mm.
It's probably not a bad idea. Thanks so much for coming in and being on Democracy Sausage.
It's a pleasure talking to you as always, Mark.
It's been terrific having you on. That's it for this week. You can, of course, contact us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum. That's APPS Policy Forum, and by email. And you can find the Facebook page if you type in Policy Forum Pod into the search bar. So until next week, thanks for being with us, and we'll talk to you then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.